Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky and disturbing children's books, films and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybrow, and today we have returning guest Ali Kay to talk about the TV series Children of the Stones from 1977. A full transcript of this episode is available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Happy day.
Happy day. Happy day, Ali.
Happy day, Ren.
Welcome back. It's very good to have you back.
Thank you.
As our regular correspondent on Standing Stones.
Yep.
For Still Scared.
So last time Ali was here, you were talking about...
Marianne Dreams.
And Paper House, the
and
film.
Paper House, yeah.
Which have both have sort of Standing Stones, but of a slightly more anthropomorphic bent in the original book.
Yeah, I can't. It seems like a long time ago now. I just remember them being quite sinister.
Yeah, they have eyes and peer in at windows
and stomp along.
They're definitely pretty mobile.
So, yeah, this time we are talking about Children of the Stones, which is a 7-episode British TV series, which was first broadcast in 1977, rebroadcast once in 1978, and then never played again on the BBC.
Stricken from the records.
Yeah, apparently. How did we come to this? How did this happen? Why are we here? What's going on?
Well, okay, let's not start with the big questions.
I mean, I think it might be because of Stuart Lee.
I think it's because of Stuart Lee, actually. I think Stuart Lee has resurrected Children of the Stones for a...
single-handedly.
Millennial generation.
Yeah.
basically on Charlie Brooker's screen wipe. Some years ago now, probably like a decade back, which is horrible to think about, Stuart Lee was complaining in his grumpy old man way about the first season of Skins. Remember Skins? Remember when Skins was on?
Not really. Yeah.
My brother liked it. I remember it when it used to be on, and I complaining to him and saying, "Oh, there's nothing like my life," and my brother saying, it's just like my life. Yeah, made me feel very bitter and alienated. But this is precisely what Stuart Lee was saying about Skins and why you like Children of the Stones. That he felt that watching Children of the Stones, you know, he related to these kind of outcast, slightly nerdy kids.
Weirdos.
Yeah. If you look at the depictions of teenagers in television today, they're kind of selfish, avaricious, out for themselves. They're also kind of confident and sassy and cool, and they're really, really at home with sex and drugs. If you look at portrayals of teenagers in the 70s in, say, something like Children of the Stones or The Changes, they're really terrified of the world, and they're uncomfortable and alienated and alone. And I think that is much truer to what it's really like to be a teenager than the way you see them in Skins.
It's very kind of low key and British in some regards, but then it also has these very campy elements, and it's a folk horror basically. In as much as we've got these two characters, Adam Brake, who's an astrophysicist, and his son Matthew, Are you laughing at him, Nick? He's an astrophysicist. He's a real,
real job.
Honest to God, astrophysicist. And he does astrophysicist things like measuring the electricity of stones, actually.
Yeah, which is exactly what astrophysicists do.
Well, as far as I know, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it will eventually become sort of useful that he's an astrophysicist, but it is a complete coincidence.
It's fate. It's all fate. It's not a coincidence. It's the law of the stones.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's not a coincidence.
These two characters, played by Gareth Thomas and
who I think Peter is Demon. Then later in Blake 7. So, you know, well, I mean, I think he was Blake.
Titular Blake
of Blake 7. So, well, you know, he did all right. Yeah, I don't think Peter Demon was in much after this, and you can perhaps see why.
What do you mean? We could have gone doing something for Peter Denham. Anyway, yeah.
Sorry, Peter.
Yeah, he might well be. If this is his only acting job, he probably is listening.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, not his only one.
I was going to cut this all out, but I think this is good stuff.
Okay. Well, insulting the actors.
Yeah, wait, sorry.
I thought he was rather good myself. But anyway, so we can get into that.
Yeah.
So, I call it folk horror in as much as we've got these two characters. I mean, we don't know if they're city slickers. I imagine that they come from a more urbane environment. Or urban environment, as you might say.
Yeah, it's not really clear where they come from.
But they come from... They're outsiders. They come into this... rural folk community with their weird traditions like Morris dancing.
Mm-hmm. And as you've said, the father, Adam, is there to measure the electromagnetic energy of the stones with his special box.
Well, he's a scientist, of course, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's... The ominousness starts pretty early. We'll talk about the soundtrack for the sort of wailing, overlapping choral music begins the show.
It's great because I think even I can, like, I reckon we could have a good go at it, right? Because it doesn't really have many rhythms as far as I can tell. It's just sort of like, oh, 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 oh. Just overlay that a few times.
Wait till texture of the week, Adam.
Yeah. Oh, and whispery bits too. Like, and I kept trying to work out if they were saying "Happy Day" in whisper. Like, happy day,
oh no,
happy
they
day.
Are.
Happy day, happy day.
I thought it was "Run Away." I thought the whispers were something. Run away, run away.
Happy but day, happy day, run away.
Yeah, could be.
I think it was "Happy Day."
Okay, yeah.
Milky Way.
It's a lot of options.
House of Stairs now.
Product placement, you know, in the 70s.
So this choral music and images of the stones. So this was filmed in a village in Wiltshire that has these standing stones, and they're pretty impressive looking things.
Have either of you ever been to Avebury?
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
I thought you were going to be like our roving reporter. But the
looks
camera
pretty good though, doesn't it?
Yeah, the camera gets right up in there, doesn't it? Like, there's some shots which look like they're meant to be point of view shots, but if they are, then the kid's like pushing his head right up against those stones because the camera's like really tracing the stones' contours and everything.
Yeah, I went on a little Google Earth visit this morning.
Oh, that's nice.
Have a look at them. Yeah.
Did you do Street View?
Yeah. Just, yeah. So you can just have a little nosy at the stones in their field.
Well, was there anything creepy, like, captured on the by the Google cameras? Half cats or...?
No half cats, oh. No. No unconscious people lying at the foot of the stones having experienced the psychic energy.
Seems a bit suspicious. You'd think there would be one.
You'd think that they would at least stage it for the Google cameras, wouldn't they?
Get all the village to like line up and hold hands.
Yeah, that's what people want. Surely that's the main thing Avebury's known for. Yeah, tourist board missed a trick that day.
Yeah. Kids, get your flares on. Yeah, as the father and son are driving into the village, we see for a split second the image of a standing stone in the road, and it's kind of almost in the shape of a person with their arms up, but it materialises into a real person, who's Miss Crabtree, the housekeeper who's come to meet them.
Yeah.
And
I guess it would have been too obvious if they called her, like, Miss Crabstone or something.
Mrs. Stone Lady.
Stone,
yeah. Yeah. No, it misleads you with both a crab and a tree.
Yeah.
And don't have anything to do with her deal.
Crabs or trees.
It's a real kind of pull back and reveal. It leads you down one road. You're like, okay, there's something going on here about the crabs. It's them who are sending out those electric magnetic rays.
But when they... the father and son settle into their cottage. They show Mrs. Crabtree a painting they brought with them. showing a standing stone circle that looks a lot like the village of Milbury.
Well, you say a lot like, I mean... can we call it a daubing rather than a painting? A painting suggests a higher quality than it really has achieved, I would say, in the representational stakes, at least.
It's got a weird cartoonish sort of aesthetic. It's very ugly.
Oh, it's horrible. It looks like an illustration out of one of the bad Choose Your Own Adventure books. Oh. Like, not even one of the better ones. Like, you know, like, number 87 or something, you know, like...
Yeah, I guess it's that sort of kind of high fantasy / sci-fi style that you would see on kind of book covers and things.
Very, very brown.
By the looks of it, number 87 is Exiled to Earth, illustrated by Frank Bowl. And I have to say, actually, which it's got these two kids in spacesuits alighting for a space portal on possibly a sort of Aztec or Mayan temple, and it's better than the painting.
Yeah. It shows the villagers holding hands in a ring around a massive column of light issuing from the centre of the circle. And when Mrs. Crabtree sees this, she faints instantly.
Yeah. There's a lot of that in this. People faint at the drop of the hat. Like, whatever's going on in the village seems to cause people to faint all the time.
Well, if I, for one, saw such an ugly painting, I'm sure my aesthete sense would cause me to faint too.
My favourite thing about the painting is that everybody treats it throughout as almost a sort of documentary evidence of what happened in pagan times. Despite it very clearly being sort of a pretty modern style painting, it doesn't make any sense.
You just found it in a charity shop. Yeah. Someone's GCSE art painting.
Yeah. But that's the first sort of hint that Matt's got some sort of special powers, which he later manifests more. And also there's a bit about how... So his mother's died his mother and Adam's wife. And there's a mention that Adam had to stop Matthew kind of handling his mother's possessions because he'd have these very vivid memories of her. Foreshadowing.
Or yep. Maybe he didn't want his son's sticky fingers or messing around with his late wife's possessions.
You know, it'd be fair.
Dripping his horrible sandwiches on
Oh, yeah. Has anyone tried any of the sandwich? Because last time we did the podcast, we had, I don't know if it's a new section, but Ren tried the posset. There's a posset in Boxer's Lights and Ren, so I don't know if, Ren, if you're going to halfway through go and make one of these sandwiches and try it.
Ham and apple crumble.
I'd rather not.
No. Di gives quite a, we haven't got on to Di yet, but he does have quite a good recipe for roast chicken, which I would eat.
I think all of Matt's horrible sandwiches are like beef and blancmange and stuff.
So. I think they've pretty much all got ham in. Ham is kind of the base, I think. And then,
Do you think he uses,
works
like,
around that. There's ham and banana with gherkins and honey, which isn't the worst one. And then there's, what's in the second one? Ham, mint jelly, mayonnaise and apple crumble.
That's pretty vile.
And I don't think I've got, that's those two. there's another good one that's at the end, but I'm not sure. But yeah, this is sort of, just kind of comes in, but actually we've already mentioned it, but it doesn't really come up until sort of the third episode that he has this sandwich thing where he likes weird sandwiches. and then it like happens twice more. I don't know, I feel like it wasn't really established enough to make sense as a kind of a character quirk.
Very soon after they arrive, Matthew's sent off to explore and meets Bob, who's local kid who shows him around.
Oh, I really liked Bob early on. He really lost his way. Like he was a great kid. Like I was really pro Bob early on. Like Phoebe was like, oh, this kid's weird, and I was like, no, come on, give him a chance. I like Bob. He's got a sunny disposition.
Well,
okay, that he may have been brainwashed or something, but I like to think that that's just Bob, you know.
So sort of odd little things happen, like they're racing their bikes and Matt sees an oncoming lorry which Bob appears to ride right into, but then when Matt opens his eyes again the road's clear. Sort of weird little things, and also
it's just Bob.
It's just Bob. They stop at the corner shop and Matthew meets Sandra for the first time, and she says some cryptic things about new people having to stick together. Matthew observes that Sandra's a bit strange. Bob says that's because she's not a happy one. So this is our first introduction of the happy folk.
And I think, does the shopkeeper do the first happy day when they leave?
I think, or Bob greets her with a happy day, but yeah, I think it's in the shop.
Yeah.
Happy day, boys.
Happy day, Mrs. Warner.
Sandra's previously appeared in a sort of sinister way at the window as well. She's quite good at being spooky, Sandra.
Quite like a little girl in The Wicker Man, just to get our first Wicker Man reference in there early.
Although there is more Morris dancing in Children of the Stones than there is in The Wicker Man.
Yep.
Although there's a hobby horse in both, isn't there?
Yes.
Adam, meanwhile, meets Sandra's mum, Margaret.
In the pub. They've gone to the pub. They're always in the pub.
Right, very, so, very, very dank little pub.
With a bartender whose face we never see.
It's true.
I didn't notice that. Wait, is it hidden by a screen?
No, he's just always got his back to the camera. But it I mean, I don't know. Do you have to pay extra for their face?
It's just a bit weird. I mean, you have to pay them extra for their voice. So, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Maybe he has a stone face. Yeah, Margaret and Sandra are also recent arrivals to Milbury. And Margaret also has theories about the stones, so they're
introduced by Hendrik, which is important, right? Because when they're still in the cottage before they've gone to the pub, when Mrs. Crabtree faints, she's sort of revived by Hendrik suddenly appearing behind her, like from nowhere, even though they're all in the cottage and sort of between where Mrs. Crabtree is and the door. So he just sort of manifests, yeah, touching her on the shoulder, and she kind of comes back to life. And then Adam's like, oh, we've got to do business chat. So off you go, Matthew. So, yeah, from the start, Hendrik is quite sinister. I really like Hendrik. I think he's great.
Yes, he certainly does a lot of eye acting.
Yeah.
So Hendrik is the kind of, I don't know, I was going to say owlish. I don't know. He's like a sort of owl crossed with a stoat, maybe. He's the kind of lord of the manor, I suppose.
Yeah. Then he introduces Adam to Margaret and sort of makes a big point of the fact that she's a widow and she has a daughter. And it's really like,
He's a bit of a matchmaker.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Definitely.
Although, to be fair, later on he's talking to his loyal butler, who says, there is much to be said for a celibate life. And he replies, and yet I have my children.
Yeah.
He considers them all his children. They're all his children.
Yeah.
Not in a dodgy 70s cult way. I mean, this is a dodgy 70s cult.
Yeah, no, that is how he means it, I think.
I mean, is he mostly in it for the power, do you think? I mean,
well, he explicitly says that power is the only thing, the only human goal.
Yeah, that is a fairly explicit.
Yeah.
A fair point, well made. Yeah.
I mean, he does also seem to think that people will be, you know, better off when he's absorbed all the
psychic energies.
A sin or whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't know. Sin is treated in quite a nebulous way, I think, in this programme. Like, there's a little bit of debate as, is sin, like, the equivalent of free will in his mind?
It's more sort of negative energy. And like negativity.
Yes. Okay. I think that's a bit. I think that's what
somehow taking that away makes you really, really good at maths.
So I don't know if the energy being configured as like negative energy kind of ties this to a critique of like 70s free love cults. If it's meant to be kind of critiquing that kind of hippie ideology of the time.
Well, there was I was reading something recently about something called the Human Potential Movement.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Which I think started in the 70s and was a kind of sort of proto, like The Secret, sort of all about giving out the positive energy and the world will bring you what you need and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that seems closer to what's going on here, because there's no real kind of elements of the, sort of the aesthetics of hippiness or free love or any of that.
There's no psychedelica or anything. I mean, it sort of, I guess, plays into the folk revival, but that's not really exactly equatable.
No.
I think it's more like a horrible business. Ah. Like a horrible work thing where you know, where the boss is like, we're all one big happy family. Everyone's so happy.
Oh, but you're not.
Yeah.
But they are.
They are, because they're the boss.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like, I mean, I'm going to have to be careful here because, you know, I am employed. But it's like when the vice chancellor of a certain university I may or may not be affiliated with came to do an introductory talk, and you know, it was generally quite good, but one thing she did say was, you know, well, we're all of equal value here, you know, no one is more important than another, you know, the cleaners are just as important as me in my role. And I kind of felt like, sort of, you know, sort of saying, oh, are we all going to be paid the same then?
Yeah.
I didn't say that, obviously, I'm still employed. But...
I mean, he's very much opening himself up to that critique with that statement.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess you do get that kind of rhetoric within businesses, right?
Hmm. So yeah, that's my reading of it. That Hendrix is a kind of terrible boss.
But, I mean, he definitely does see himself as being in charge, and as being kind of an authority figure. And then, yeah, exactly what his motivations are and what his plan is, I'm not totally clear on.
Yeah, I mean, he's sometimes referred to as a kind of, later on, as a kind of magus or just a priest, and I wasn't sure if the show is generally kind of sceptical about the role of the priest in a career, because I think it's an interesting show, right? Because obviously it's got this kind of dialectic between faith and reason, I suppose. So, you know, there's the question of, well, you know, are ley lines responsible for this buildup of psychic energy, and are there things beyond the senses which, you know, control our destinies on some level?
And the answer is definitely yes.
But our heroes are scientists, right, essentially,
yeah,
and tend to use resolutely, yeah, you know, are like, right, I want to use my, you know, oscillator to solve the problem.
They get persuaded pretty quickly, though, really, I think.
Yeah, you kind of, but then it kind of is just folded into the scientific paradigm, right? Like, so it's like, okay, ley lines, yep, like, how are we going to study that then? Everything, like, any mysticism, like, is rendered quite kind of scientific and rational by the protagonists quite quickly, I think.
I think that's almost a feature of a lot of, like, actual New Age stuff, though.
That's interesting.
So, like, I think the way they talk about, like, ley lines and, like, energy and forces and electromagnetism and things is, you know, you do get that language in, like, specifically this, that kind of, like, New Age approach to the supernatural.
Well, like, this is the crystal you need to solve such and such a problem.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, I don't feel like it's that they are being sceptical or sort of saying kind of, oh, well, if this is happening, then we've got to be able to measure it. Like, okay, they're quite accepting of the idea that Matthew is psychic. They don't really do anything to try and work out how he can see
that's true. Other people's experiences or psychic energies,
through objects that belong to them, which is the power he ends up having.
One of the first examples of the psychic energy is quite soon after, well, in their first meeting, Margaret invites Adam down to the stones to touch a stone.
Touch the stone.
To see if he's the kind of man that she thinks he is.
Well, so my sister was laughing all the way through this sequence and found it very funny indeed.
Which, yeah, it's quite a coy way of putting it.
Yeah.
But the kind of man he is, I guess, is he touches the stone and is like, sees florid visions and then falls unconscious.
Well, he flies, he doesn't just fall, he flies backwards.
He flies unconscious, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Margaret's very apologetic and is like, oh, yes, I was wondering if you had some sort of psychic sense of these stones, because I saw some things when I touched them, but it wasn't as strong as that. And he goes, oh, no, well, surely it's magnetism. And they have a little argument about that.
Although, as the insane clown posse say, effing magnets, how do they work?
I mean, that is the central question of this show. What is a magnet?
We just don't know.
These stones really shouldn't be magnetic, but Adam's there to do some astrophysics on them, so he'll work it out. The part after he's been knocked unconscious, he has one of my favourite lines. So as he's coming to, Margaret says, oh, I'll get you some water. And he says, this is no time of day for a bath. And then demands whiskey. But it's really jarring because, I don't know, it's such a weird response. It's like, he's concussed or something, and then you realise he's just being...
wacky.
Yeah. Just wants booze.
Yeah, you're right. There is quite a lot of boozing in this programme, generally. Like, there's a fair amount of whiskey, and... does he... I can't remember. Does the son drink as well?
No.
I'm sure there was a bit where he sort of jokingly or half-jokingly offers him, like, some whiskey as well.
Maybe.
I can't remember. That definitely sounds like something that could have happened, but yeah.
He's a good kid, isn't he?
I'm surprised we don't see anyone smoking, actually.
No.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, no, Matt is an obnoxiously good kid.
Okay, so
he's so resentful of all the happy day children, because they're, you know, they're better than him. They can do maths better than him.
Yeah, you mentioned the school. When he turns up at the school on the first day, one of the boys tries to... antagonize him and trip him over to check that he's human, and the kids are split into two groups. There's the kind of the quiet, obedient, sort of supernaturally clever children all together at one table, and the four normal kids on their own, like, mini oak tables.
It's weirdly similar to that Simpsons episode, right, when they move to the sort of model town when Homer gets the new job and Bart gets put in the class for, like, slower students. Because, like, all the students are really far in advance, and then, you know, he's just, like, put with, you know, essentially, you know, the kids who aren't up to speed or whatever and is disgruntled about it. I thought, yeah, oddly similar situation.
Sorry, girl.
This is a kind of an aside, but at the school, on their notice board, they have these orange pamphlets up on the wall, which are from the metrication board when Britain switched over to the metric system. And I have some of those framed on my wall because my parents found them, and my great aunt's piles of stuff when she died. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a good spot.
I tried to get a picture, but it was focusing on the characters and what they were doing.
Disgusting. So watching the scenes in the school, did you feel really homely? Were you like, oh, this is kind of like being in my room?
Yeah. Oh, the leader. I know about those. Yeah.
The teacher's really cutting about all the sort of normal, non-happy kids as well. Just like, oh, you won't ever be, you won't be able to do this. There's no point in asking you if you could do this all the time. Yeah,
yeah. They're like all in the naughty corner.
And poor, poor Bob gets straight up punched in the face.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I see how it makes you laugh. Poor Bob, it's horrid.
Yeah.
And, but he's very smug about it.
No, he's not. He's like Jesus. He's not smug.
I mean, no, he is. He gets punched, and then he's like, see, it didn't solve anything, did it? And walks off.
Yeah, he's like, consider the lily.
He is quite smug, Adam.
Well, you know... I mean, I'm just saying that if he's smug, well, maybe Jesus is a bit smug, and I wouldn't say that. I'm not saying Bob's Jesus, but he's the closest thing we have to Jesus in the show.
In this godless village.
In this godless village, yeah, they should worship Bob.
I mean, to be fair, everybody in the show is. Well, not everybody, but a lot of the characters, including, you know, the heroes, are very smug a lot of the time.
That's true, so. Actually, yeah.
Yeah. So we get sort of some history of the stones from... because Margaret is the curator of the local museum, and Adam goes to visit her, and she shows him a skeleton, which is a nice date. Who is a barber surgeon who was buried under one of the stones. Or was crushed under one of the stones when they were trying to bury the stone.
So what is a bar? Is this a thing? Like a historic thing? A barber
surgeon? Oh, yes, it is. It is. So back in the day before surgery was its own profession, it was done on the side by barbers.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, they didn't have anaesthetic or anything, so it was just chopping.
So like you'd have a lot of people having their, you know, beards groomed and hair, and then someone else would come along and like, oh, I've got a really bad kidney, and they'd be like, oh yeah, well, I just use my scissors, like, or my razor. I don't understand.
I don't know if they'd do a kidney, but they'd chop a leg off.
Jesus Christ! What, like, with the same implements? They'd cut and you get.
Blood and stuff in the hair.
Yeah, they probably had different things.
Yeah. Ooh. It's just like, yeah, you know, I mean, a side gig for a barber.
It's awful.
They used to do teeth as well. I think they carried on doing teeth for a bit longer.
Well, I understand, because I heard...
The rest of the body.
I heard about, you know, those barber's poles, which are red and white, and that signifying, like, you know, blood and... I don't know, foam. So maybe that's why I was thought, well, why, who are these terrible hairdressers, you know, with all this blood, you know? Well, I guess if they're also surgeons on the side, that explains it. Jeez.
Yeah.
I mean, what isn't explained is how they know this skeleton was a barber surgeon, or why it's called a barber surgeon.
Yeah.
My DVD skipped a bit at this point, and I thought I'd missed some sort of explanation of that, but I hadn't.
No.
You had some scissors in one hand and a cleaver in the other, I guess.
Yeah, unexplained. Yeah, apparently they used to bury one of the stones a year for good luck.
Oh, we didn't know that.
Yeah, but then it's like...
I missed that.
But how are there any stones left? But then I guess if people turn into stones, then they get more stones.
Oh, it's just like the natural cycle of life, you know, you bury stones, people turn into stones, and the beautiful cycle continues.
Perfect ecosystem.
Yeah. She also tells him that there used to be two more avenues of stones extending from the circle, which formed the head and tail of the solar serpent, which was the symbol of inner truth. And this serpent symbol comes back.
It turns out she's been reading all this off the sign that's behind her.
Are you a fan of the solar serpent, Ali? You seem...
I mean, I don't know that I've really encountered the Solar Serpent in this, in the form that it seems to be being described.
Do you think it's quite a spurious?
I mean, I don't know.
Well, I mean, this is what the internet's for, I suppose. Solar Serpent.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know. I think it's a bit. What's the word? Ad hoc. It's a bit ad hoc.
I don't know. Here it says, "Red Serpent is your conscious self, who you are and who you are becoming. I am the flint and tinder of the sacred fire," reads the meditation for Red Serpent, and that's from astrodreamadvisor.com.
Well, they should know.
Yeah.
Mm.
But at the same time, I do think you could put basically any two
words. Solar and animal.
Yes.
Solar weevil.
I tried Solar Bear, but that's a nice hockey team. So.
But what a nice hockey team.
That logo is a bear wearing sunglasses. It's pretty good.
It's a pretty cool bear.
A polar bear. Yeah. Anyway, that's a digression.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the internet for you.
They didn't have that in the 70s. That's why they were so concerned with maps and
good at maths.
And good at maths.
Yeah.
And they had to put pictures of bicycles in rabbit snares to meet people.
Well, to make your own fun.
To make your own fun. We haven't really talked about Dai yet.
So. Okay. Whose main means of communication is the exchange of a picture of a bicycle on a piece of paper.
Yes. I can't really explain that in a way that makes more sense, because that is just what happens.
That's just what happens. Yeah. Yeah.
So Dai is the possible reincarnation of a barber surgeon.
Oh.
Well, that was my understanding. That was my understanding.
So what happens to Dai is that he sort of wanders around giving the kids sort of mysterious warnings, and is pretty much the only person in the village who's not a happy one. And this is apparently because he lives at the sanctuary where people are safe, although it doesn't... It seems really to be because he has a special amulet with a picture of a snake on.
It's definitely the amulet, because it shatters before he dies.
Yeah, the sanctuary doesn't really ever seem to really do anything helpful, even though it's sort of lauded as being, you know, a special safe place.
More like a sanctuary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the amulet gets broken, and then Dai is... Well, he just dies, really.
As per his name.
And then the kids are kind of running to see what's happened to him. And there's just a big rock on the ground. My understanding is that the rock is the rock that had originally crushed the barber surgeon, but the barber surgeon is Dai having gone back in time.
Okay.
His dead body having gone back in time.
Oh.
And that's why it has the other half of the amulet. So it's broken, and Matt ends up with one half.
So, Dai's like a zombie.
Barber surgeon's
book. So Dai's a zombie?
No, it's a time... The barber surgeon is just his body that's gone back in time.
Oh, okay.
Posthumously.
Okay. That kind of makes sense.
We're trying our best with this plot.
Yeah.
It's It's not the easiest thing to explain.
Well, okay, the problem is this plot has time loops in it. And time loops make plots quite difficult.
It was definitely the time loops and not holes. I'm sure the creators understood exactly how everything had connected together and had made sense.
Well, it's a great sleight of hand, though. You know, if your script is some plot holes, I would advise turn them not from plot holes to plot loops.
Stephen Moffat.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
But yeah, Di's pretty good, like...
He's Welsh, is he Welsh? Yeah.
I mean, it's a Welsh name.
He has the spirit of Welshness about him.
Yeah, no, he is referred to as being Welsh.
Okay.
Adam at one point.
And he's a sort of poacher kind of village persona. And yeah, he takes an interest in Matt from when they arrive and gives him the first time they meet, gives him very sinister warnings about how no one ever leaves the circle.
And Matt is absolutely there for it. I mean, Matt just loves Di. Like, there's one bit where I can't remember. I think his father is saying, well, you know, why do you believe this hunch or something? And Matt's just like, Di knew it. Good enough for me. Like, if Di says it, it's right, okay? But yeah,
he does earlier refer to him as like being an old nutter and things like that, which seems a bit unfair because Di's, you know, he's not he's pretty lucid. I mean, not, you know, that it's okay anyway, but yeah, he's a bit cryptic, but...
He has a habit of popping up at windows, but I don't think we can hold that against him particularly.
Yeah.
No.
I like Di. I think one of the most likeable characters, mostly because he's less smug than almost all of the other characters.
Yeah. So, on one of their first... Adam and Matt's one of their first night in the village. Everyone else in the village seems to disappear, apart from the other new arrivals. And Matt's sort of in his room working on plotting out ley lines or something, and he hears chanting and goes out to investigate and finds the villagers holding hands in a circle around the stones and chanting.
Can we do some chanting?
Yeah, it's like that.
it's just really eerie warbling. But it's really creepy.
Yeah, I mean, the... soundtrack, like the chanting and the chanting also like forms the theme tune, and lots of the other like soundtrack of the show, and it's definitely one of the creepiest things about it. I think,
yeah, I mean, the chanting just sort of becomes flat out screaming in parts, really.
I was also, when I was watching it on rewatching it on 1.75 speed this morning, it became even stranger.
So he goes outside, Matthew, because Di has chucked this rock with the picture of the bicycle wrapped round it through his window. Because that's, you know, how you had to communicate in the late 70s.
Yep.
And so he goes outside and then he encounters the people singing and then Di knocks him out, I think. Or does he just make him touch a stone and then that knocks him out?
Yeah, I don't know. No, I think he does that.
And then, yeah, later on, Di's like, oh, yeah, I saved you. Which, so, but if he hadn't chucked the rock through the window to make him go outside in the first place, he'd have been quite happy just sitting there drawing ley lines. But, yeah, anyway. I'm sure he had his reasons. He's a pretty sensible man,
Di. To be fair, maybe he just didn't think it through.
Yeah.
So that there's a sort of ongoing thing where they're trying to, where they're sort of all like Sandra and Matthew and Adam and Margaret is kind of discussing how after people have been in the village for a while they change and become these happy dayers, and what is it that makes them change.
Yeah, they figure out the thing that everybody's kind of brainwashed, like, quite quickly, really.
Mm.
Most of... I mean, obviously it's only a 7-episode TV show, and they're not long episodes, so there's not a lot of time to be dithering around. But yeah, most of it is more sort of trying to work out exactly how people have been changed, rather than, like, finding out that, that's happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of similar setup to the Demon Headmaster. Some 20 years later, in a way.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a parallel there. The particularly with the normal kids and the brainwashed kids.
Yeah, it's a bunch of outsiders trying to work out, pierce the veil, work out what's going on with the evil adult institution of power.
Mm-hmm. I thought the Morris dancing scene was really great.
I mean, is Morris dancing implicitly creepy?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that people who do Morris dancing would, you know,
fervently disagree. No.
I want to lean into it.
Yeah. I think so.
I mean, it's definitely a curious dancing because it's one of the only dances that I know of that has very little rhythm.
Mm.
Like, you know, I mean, there's not much ebb and sway or general...
It has a rhythm, it just doesn't vary very much.
Yeah, I suppose.
There's only so much you can do with, like, bells and sticks and things.
That's true, if you are going to build your dance around bells and sticks.
Mm. Ankle bells, no less.
Yeah.
It's good, actually. In the Unitarian Carol Service I went to this year, there was Morris dancing. And after this, I read The Bells by Edgar Allan Poe, which, I mean, you know, it's loosely festive. Like, the first stand, it starts out Christmassy, and then Poe kind of loses interest, moves on to Wedding Bells, and then for most of the poem it's just big gothic bells and people crying out in lament. Anytime I repeated the refrain of the bells, 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 I got the Morris dancers to twinkle their bells, which probably weren't the kind of bells that Poe was imagining, admittedly.
Not the most gothic form of bell.
But yeah. It did make the poem seem a little bit more appropriate for the occasion, hopefully.
The Morris dancing is significant because Tom the farmer is part of it, who had previously been pretty openly contemptuous about Morris dancing, apparently, but is now merrily jingling away
along with his adorable son.
Yeah, who we already know has been brainwashed because now he can suddenly do maths.
Yeah. It ends with them lifting the son Jimmo in the air and shouting "Happy Day!" it's just great. I really enjoyed that bit. it seems that there is celebratory Morris dancing after each new person is brainwashed and joins the fold.
Sadly, we miss the other instances of that.
Well, I mean, Adam does complain at one point and says, oh, it seems like, you know, you've got a lot of Morris dance. It seems like you're Morris dancing every evening.
Yeah, there's a lot of brainwashing.
Yeah. Well, especially if people are turning into stones, you know, I guess you've got to keep up with that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can't...
You've got to keep making more.
Well, let's be honest. What's the use of a brainwashed stone?
It's a good point.
A serious ontological question, that.
So this is kind of about where we come to the Matthew being sort of psychic that we've mentioned. The remaining normal people convene and kind of discuss about how people are being brainwashed and if it's planned or not. And then the doctor leaves and says he's going to visit one of his old patients outside of the village. But he leaves his gloves behind, and when Matthew touches the gloves, he can see what the doctor is doing. So he sees the doctor sort of in his car trying to drive out of Milbury, but then something blocks his path, and then the picture fades. So the doctor's... We think the doctor's been stopped in some way from leaving the village.
He's been squabbled.
It's very, very much reminded me of the Midwich Cuckoos.
Yeah.
At this point, well, creepy children anyway. But the creepy children in the Midwich Cuckoos stop anyone from leaving Midwich in a fairly similar way. But the next day, the doctor goes to see Adam and Margaret at the museum, and he says, oh no, I went out to see my patient, you know, nothing happened out of the ordinary. But then when he leaves, he says, well, happy day. And they're like, dun, dun, yeah. Dun.
All the evidence we need.
No, I just meant I was feeling especially happy today.
I mean, it is a bit weird at this point, because they don't really know what's happening, and basically the only thing that's sinister is that everybody's really happy and good at maths, and nobody's done, like, anything bad.
Well, it is quite the dystopia, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, who feels happy when doing maths? Like, I remember doing my GCSE maths homework... And that was one of the, you know, I'm not even joking, actually. Like, I really did feel quite deeply unhappy doing it.
Yeah, no, same, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I remember staying up at night just despairing.
Yeah. God, did you have to did you have to do nets? Like, you know, like, we had to do the, you know, folding paper things into like cubes or whatever, and it becoming increasingly difficult. I just remember making loads of paper shapes. It was horrible.
All I remember is that our coursework involved like a big grid, and it was like 7x7, and there were just like, I just remember lines and numbers, and I couldn't work out where the numbers were meant to go in the lines, and it was just horrible.
Yeah.
So imagine how amazing it would be if you had all your negative energy stripped away and you could just do, you know, the Hilbert transform or whatever it is that...
I guess I might be pretty happy.
Jimmo though. Suddenly knows how to solve.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would be pretty, pretty useful.
But yeah, they haven't really...
Yeah, but the point
done anything.
Yeah, but the point is they haven't got the free will to suffer.
I guess what I'm saying is that at this point in the narrative, Adam and Matt and Margaret and Sandra, like, are very sort of freaked out about everything, but nothing that bad really seems to be happening around them. I mean, it does later turn out that, yes, like, everybody's being essentially brainwashed, but I don't know. I think the main thing is how sort of aggressively especially Matt, how aggressive Matt is towards the people who have been brainwashed, and especially Mrs. Crouch.
That's true.
Who mostly just offers him, like, offers him chocolate cake and, like, breakfast and things. Is basically quite nice. He's like, yes, I suppose I'll have eggs and sausages and fried bread and chocolate cake.
Yeah, that is true.
It's like, you're really, I mean, I know she is brainwashed, but you are being quite rude.
Yeah. Yeah. Bad form, Matt.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is about when things sort of step up a bit of a creepy notch, because the children see the fallen stone with the image of the serpent of it. They go and tell Margaret, and she says that it's the same location where the barber surgeon was crushed. Then they go out to look, but then instead of a stone, there's Di, dead, with the broken amulet next to him. Adam goes to Hendricks to call the police, and Hendricks says, "Well, I don't think we'll bother with the police." And it's just going to show me where this body is. So Adam reluctantly takes Hendricks to look at the body, but it's disappeared and been replaced just by a sort of scattering of stones.
They're sort of in a pattern, but I couldn't work out if there was any significance to that or what the pattern would be.
I feel like you're watching this like you're playing an adventure game.
Yeah.
Like a missed puzzle.
Badly constructed adventure.
Yeah.
So Hendricks, back at his house, tells his butler that he wants to make everyone one big happy family, and but he has to do it in the order in which they've arrived in the village, so Margaret and Sandra have to be invited first to dinner. Yeah. Meanwhile, Matthew puts together some pieces of the amulet and gets a psychic vibe from it. So he starts sort of getting visions, and he's just sort of throwing words out, like village, circle, visitor, beginning, shining, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's very Prius.
But more laboured.
Yeah. And they puzzle about this for a while. And
this is just ages of Adam and Margaret just sort of constructing, like, different sequences of the words together. Like,
yeah.
Priest, bright, visitor, a visiting priest?
Yeah, it's like they're doing a crossword or something.
And there's a bit where they look at, say, one of the words is beam, and Adam sort of looks at the painting and is like, looks at the massive beam of light in the middle of it and says, "Could this be the beam?" It's like, well, yeah, I think it probably is the beam.
Eventually they strike on visitor bright and shining and decide that this means supernova.
Seems like a bit of a stretch. But yeah. The supernova has already come up, though, because they're doing these measurements on the stone, and Matthew figures out that, well, first he thinks all the stones are at an angle, and then he measures them using Di's telescope and realises that they're actually all pointing straight upwards, which, yeah, I mean, it's unclear to me how you would tell which direction a stone is pointing in. But anyway, they're all pointing directly upwards. So his dad's like, "Oh, they're pointing at something directly above us, but there's nothing there." So he telegrams off to the observatory that's in the US, and they telegram back and say, "Oh, there's a black hole there." But yeah, that's
the big reveal, where we learn that it's Hendrick's supernova / black hole. And that he, too, is an astrophysicist.
Oh, yeah, and there's a bit where, like, Adam tries to lecture him on, like, what a black hole is. And you can just see Hendricks waiting there to say, "Oh, actually, yeah, it's my frickin' supernova."
Yeah.
Oh, and also the stones are around a kind of underground bowl.
Yeah.
That's sort of a kind of receiver dish shape. That's the other tidbit we learn about the stones and their alignments.
So yeah, like, I hadn't really thought about this, but that whole sequence with Matt having the talisman, just they go from there to supernova, but they already knew about the supernova. So I don't really know why.
I mean, I think we're potentially tying ourselves in knots.
Yeah.
Possibly in reflection of the show's plotting, but...
but yeah, anyway, there's a supernova. It's a black hole.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going with this.
yeah.
And so, how is Hendrix using this black hole? Because there's the whole thing that actually the ley lines are part of a transmitter or something. Like, there's a bit where Adam's like, oh, we've got it back to front. Actually, this is the transmitter.
No, right, yeah. So they think at first that Hendrix is using the energy of the black hole to turn the villagers into happy dayers, and that the supernova used to have a benign effect, but when it turned into a black hole, the effect was reversed and it extracts the will of the people it's used on. But then they realise, in fact, that the energy doesn't come from the black hole, but from Milbury itself, from the stones, and what it's transmitting is evil.
To the black hole?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 I mean,
so.
Hmm.
Have you got to the bit where Margaret and Sandra go to dinner?
Well, yeah, we just skipped over that, but we need to talk about it because it's pretty great. yeah, so Adam decides that whatever is doing this must be happening at Hendrix, and he makes Margaret promise that she'll come back and see him after her and Sandra go for dinner. Matthew takes a scarf of Sandra's so that he can hopefully watch what's happening through the psychic object thing. So Hendrix has digital clocks all around his house, because he claims he needs absolute accuracy, although he won't say for what. But and then he takes Margaret and Sandra into his cult leader dining room.
Yeah. He's so proud of his room.
He loves it. Which is
his special throne.
Just a
special rotating throne.
Stone room up in the top of the house with a big slab of a table and big stone chairs, and his chair's bigger than all the other chairs. And
it's actually quite a small room.
Yeah.
Which I don't, yeah. Makes it slightly less impressive, and yeah.
But he has Margaret and Sandra sit on either side of him. He's at the head of the table, and Matthew's watching this happening. The villagers start their creepy chanting again. Hendrix says, "Bon appetit, my children," which is just horrifyingly creepy. and then he does his little recitation. He says, "Complete the circle, make us at one with nature and the elements." And then Matthew sees a bright light and loses contact.
He says, "Complete the circle," and yeah, that bit. And then he goes, "It is time." and sort of rotates on his chair, so he's facing away from the table, and then the roof opens and the light comes through. But he, you can see when he's rotating that he's kind of wheeling himself around on his leg, but his body's like completely bolt upright, and he's got this weird grin on his face. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty glorious. And after this, Margaret comes over to see Adam as they'd arranged, and says, "Oh no, no, I didn't go to the house after all. I stayed in, and yeah, nothing happened." Matthew catches up with Sandra, and Adam and Matthew have decided that they're leaving the village, and Sandra's like,
"Yeah, really abruptly. We don't see them have this conversation or anything."
No. And Sandra's like, "Oh, we'll be seeing you soon. You're not really going to leave."
Sandra is, I think, really good at being sinister.
That's
even when she's being sort of kind of like before she's brainwashed and is just sort of trying to solve the mystery and being kind of perky. She's still a little bit sinister.
Yeah, I think Catherine Levy does a good job of being sinister.
Yeah.
she now works as an executive producer and director of business TV.
She obviously kept the sinister sinisterness up.
Happy day business TV.
Yeah.
I really hope the cast of this show aren't going to be listening.
It's just me.
She did a very good job.
No, she's really good.
Yeah.
I think she's really good.
So before they leave, Matthew sneaks into the basement of the old church and
demands breakfast from Mrs. Crabtree.
One last time.
For old time's sake, with chocolate and cake.
But then he sneaks off before he's had his breakfast.
Oh, yeah. Whoa, what a jerk.
Yeah. And he sort of, I don't know, slides down a coal chute or something and into the basement of the church and finds Hendrik's vintage 70s room-sized computer, which is quite exciting.
It's one of the bits that I remember most about the first time I watched it, and even though it really doesn't feature for very long at all, I very clearly remembered the church having got the computers inside.
What does that mean? I seem to have a guess.
Hendrik's just quite sinister at him. And then, yeah, that's it, really.
He just takes him back home, doesn't
he?
I think Hendrik feels pretty darn assured that his plan is going to come to fruition, so he doesn't really worry too much.
Yeah. No, he's not worried.
Adam and Matthew try to drive out of the village, the same road that the doctor took earlier. But
there's lots of jump cuts of people's eyes. Mostly, that's what happens.
Yeah, and then they wake up in a spare bedroom in the big house and realise that they couldn't leave. Hendrik comes in and smarms into the room and tells them that they will have dinner with him in 45 minutes. Then Adam quite suddenly theorises that they are in a parallel universe.
Yeah, it kind of comes out of nowhere. It says, "I think we missed the turning. The time turning."
All right.
Again, a bit of a leap, but you know, he's a scientist, so.
And then this is when they do their theorising about the black hole and the energy and the what direction it's going in. And they decide.
Yeah, and they realise they're trapped, sort of in the house, because it's surrounded by villagers chanting, and also that Matthew thinks the thing that they nearly crashed into was actually Mrs. Crabtree.
Yeah.
Yeah, in her stone form.
In stone form, yeah.
Yeah, this seems to be her extra job.
It's an interesting kind of bookends things, because they crash into Mrs. Crabtree at the very start as well when they're arriving, and then she stops them leaving, apparently.
Yeah. So they make up a last minute scientific plan using their science skills, and decide that as Hendrix is using the digital clocks to time the exact alignment of his cult room with the black hole. If they change the clocks, then he will process them at the wrong time, and they won't be brainwashed. Which works. Hendrix does his whole spiel again, and seems a bit put out.
He's very upset that Adam doesn't like the room. It's like, what about my throat? And aren't you impressed by my throat?
Yeah, Adam's like, oh, it's what I expect from you, Hendrix.
So the whole process happens again, as we've seen, and the light comes down. Hendrix turns his back. Oh no, the light doesn't come down because it's not the right time.
But yeah, because Hendrix turned round, so he doesn't notice.
And Adam and Matthew pretend that they've been happified.
We are happy. We've been brainwashed.
Beep boop. And Hendrix leads them out to join the rest of the villagers in the circle. But instead, when they touch hands with the villagers, it starts to wake them up out of their brainwash state.
Yeah, the spell is broken.
And, I mean, things get pretty wild at this point, right? Like, everything goes quite blue.
The light comes down when Hendrix doesn't have his back turned and sort of comes down upon him and turns him into a beardy man.
Yeah, he becomes all old, like a biblical prophet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's... yeah, this is another interesting plot thing. So, is he meant to be the bard or druid or whatever who originally saw the supernova in the ancient pagan times? And he's somehow been kept young by this mystical practice that he's got? Is that what's meant to have happened? Yeah, he's wearing robes and stuff.
I got that impression.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, we've got to be compatibilist about this. I think it's like he's the same person, but not at the same time. Like, I know that's impossible, but you've got to keep that tension at work.
Yeah. It's hard to know exactly what's happened, but it's something like
because at the end, right, after Hendrix has been aged and presumably killed, and our protagonists try to leave the village, we have a new man who is definitely played by the same actor as Hendrix enter the village.
Yes, it's suggesting the time loop is looping again. But before that, when Hendrix is, the light descends on him, the villagers start turning to stone. In a sequence that I imagine must have been terrifying for children watching it. It's Adam and Matthew trying to escape, and like Sandra and Margaret is sort of turning to stone, all the villagers turning to stone. yeah, they flee the village to the sanctuary, thereby completing the prophecy of that painting.
I shouldn't have insulted it. The painting was right all along.
they wake up in the sanctuary, but Dai doesn't seem to recognise them, and instead of being a poacher, he's a blacksmith or something.
And alive,
yeah, furthermore. And he chucks them out of his house. Adam and Matthew find their car and leave the village again, and this time it lets them go.
But they see Margaret and Sandra and people who have been turned to stone but aren't before they go as well. It basically seems like they've ended up in a parallel timeline where none of the sort of spooky or the negative energies being sent to the black hole stuff has happened.
I thought it was just like it reset so that it was just a time loop, so that, and that like new kind of figures come to kind of fill the roles or something.
That seems like that's the implication, that something like that is happening, because then as you say, the Hendrik reappears, except that he's got a different name, driving back into the village as Matt and Adam drive away.
I mean, in some regards, it's no less cryptic than the ending of the new Twin Peaks, really. Like, watching it, I was almost expecting Adam to go, "What year is this?"
Yeah, I mean, I guess if that's our standard, then... I like the bit where they leave Margaret and Sandra, because they're just like... Oh, well, it was nice meeting you.
Yeah. Hope you like being a stone.
Yeah. Bye.
Oh, right.
Right.
That's all the plot now. We've done it.
There was so much plot.
It took a while, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean...
God, it's like everything happened and yet nothing at all.
There's quite a lot of things that don't really... go anywhere. Like, there's some stuff about the font in the church has got a snake on it and things like that that doesn't ever really get tied into.
Well, I think that's relevant because it's the same, the emblem that Dai has on his amulet, and it's like protecting him, like it's protecting the font, like it's protecting the church from the paganism.
Okay.
I think.
I thought the serpent represented paganism.
Yes. I don't know.
Should we do texture of the week?
Yeah.
Okay, I got an idea for the song. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think we should do it in the round, like in choral. So if I start with a texture of the week, and then Ren, if like on the of, you start, and then Ali, if you start on the of, and
okay. I'll try.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to try to do it in a chanty way, like in the program, and then if you
okay.
Yeah. So texture of texture the week.
Oh, that was wonderful.
Yeah.
So what is it?
Mine's just, I just want a simple one. Mine's the brass rubbing they do. So there's a bit where to get the snake symbol down, they do some brass rubbing on a piece of paper. And that's just a very nostalgic texture for me, the texture of brass rubbings. I really associate with primary school. Like going to Ipswich Museum and getting to go around to do brass rubbings of various exhibits.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Ali?
I mean, I did feel like it would be a bit willfully kind of contrary to say anything other than the actual stones. They're so...
we're relying on you for that.
They're so prominent. The beginning sequence is obviously just all close-ups of the stones and sort of zooming in on the stones and things, but they're also in like lots and lots of shots just incidentally, like people are always walking around the stones, and they've got a very, you know, they're very sort of gnarly and craggy and stony, I think they're the most important texture.
Ren, do you have an even more important texture?
My texture is the clacky-mouthed horse puppet that's part of the Morris dancing scene. It's a full-body costume with a clacky horse mouth, and it goes clack, 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 clack. And there's one of those in the Wicker Man as well.
There's repeated... kind of the sequence of seeing all the villagers round the church, seeing their faces and the kind of blue aura. That's quite a good texture.
It's very spooky, that.
It's pretty important, yeah.
Are we going to do our new segment?
Does that we have to eat a ham and apple?
No. The new segment, I think, as introduced... last time is Claim of the Week.
Oh, yes, Claim of the Week. Do you have one, Adam?
No, I wasn't sure if you had one, Ali, because of all the kind of science claims.
Oh, I should have thought about it more, because yeah, there are some claims.
Should we just put the general character of Adam as claim of the week.
Yeah, just Adam.
claim maker general.
Yeah.
Bold claim.
I mean, there's a claim about the painting where they're talking about the kind of atmospheric effect. One of the characters says, "I imagine this was just the effect the artist was after," which I thought was quite a claim, frankly. The artist was after any deliberate effect.
Good.
Do you have any final thoughts?
I'd just like to say that it is actually really good. We might have made it seem a bit arduous with all the plot stuff, but you don't really notice that so much when you're watching it, and it's just really good and atmospheric.
It does move quite quickly as well. Yeah. It gets through all that in a pretty short amount of time. Mm. I think the things that are good about it is sort of the general atmosphere and, as I say, the soundtrack, which is amazing and really spooky. Hendrix's performance is great. And so on. But yeah, it's not really something you watch for the narrative, I think. I think I felt like with this, watching it this time, I was noticing a lot of... because I was trying to follow the plot properly so that I could talk about it. And I think that... I don't think that's necessarily the best way of watching it.
Yeah.
No, I think watch it in the autumn when you're slightly drunk. Not if you're a kid. If you're a kid, drunk on cocoa, maybe. Late at night, tucked up, but maybe, you know, just slightly sleep-deprived. Just sort of taking it all in as a spooky atmosphere rather than really trying to make any sense of it.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
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 All right.
Okay.
Credits time. Our theme music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. And you can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
I think I'm going to keep it pretty simple this time and just say, happy day, creepy kids.
Happy day, creepy kids.
Happy day.
And thank you again to Ali for joining us. It's been great.
Thanks.
Well, next time we do something about Standing Stones, we'll ask you straight back.
Stone-centric things.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.